Well, I think we'll go ahead and get started. We have a quorum here. And hopefully, we'll have Steve and Kenny join us. I believe they're planning on coming. We should have someone calling in. So, it's great to... Oh, great. Okay, so here's Kenny. All right. Well, I think the first matter of business, and really the only item that needs a vote today, is the approval of minutes from the meeting of July 19th. I think those have been distributed to you, and are in the package here today. So I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes as submitted.
Second. Are there any questions or comments regarding the minutes before we take a vote? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, I think we can accept those minutes. We're really excited to have a new board member that's joined us, Kenny Shackelford, and he was not able to join our last meeting. The last meeting, Kenny, we kind of gave the new board members an opportunity to kind of introduce themselves and talk a little bit about, you know, their background and experience. So we'd like to give you that opportunity.
Sure. Yeah. So, Kenny Shackelford, United Way, senior director right now. Quick little background. I've been in Utah now for 4 years, from Chicago originally, moved here in May. I've been in early childhood for 16 years. So before I came to United Way, I was Brad Risen's, which is a corporate child care. So I came here to open up Doterra Child Care Center, Overstock Child Care Center, Goldman Child Care Center, and CHG. So basically what I did is partner with those directors to help build the schools, and they serve infants all the way through kindergarten. But I've been an infant teacher, toddler teacher, tooth teacher, director, executive director, anything early childhood, I've been there. I actually love the field. I actually came in not-for-profits. I want to actually do more of the Utah broad-based versus corporate child care. So that's why I'm here.
Welcome today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great experience in the corporate world of child care.
So my goal is to help merge more of the corporate entity with not-for-profit because they do have a lot of dollars for early childhood, and now they have 6 schools, one of them have 8 by the end of next year.
Before we get started, you'll probably notice that we all have personalized books now. I think this is really part of our process that we're getting organized, and Mary, you're to be credited with this. Maybe you could just take a minute and give us a little orientation.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. And the credit goes to Montana, who is the one who does all of the putting together of the binder materials.
Who's Montana?
Montana right here, who is with us at the Office of Child Care.
Thank you.
So I just kind of wanted to quickly walk you through this, and we're open to feedback, and we're open to doing this in whatever way the board prefers, but this is sort of a starting point, and so we'll always have the front tab with the meeting materials for today, and so that includes obviously the agenda, the slideshow that we'll go through, so you're welcome to mark it up however you want, take notes, whatever you need to do. Then we're always going to include prior meeting materials, so we'll start that with the next meeting materials. You'll see all of today's materials move to that tab. We have a contact list under board membership so that if you would like to contact each other, you're welcome to do that. The Public Meetings Act, the handbook that the state of Utah uses, and then we'll eventually add in the governance documents for this body and additional materials as we move along. So I'll mention that our goal is to not have this be work for you, and so while you're welcome to mark up the materials however you want, we'll take the binders and always bring them back for you with the new materials, unless you prefer to take, if you have notes on them and you prefer to rip your sheets out and take them with you, you're welcome to do that, but we'll collect the binders at the end of every meeting and bring them back for you and just kind of have this as sort of your ongoing booklet for everything related to this board. So feel free to email me if you have any feedback or things that you'd like to have included in here. We'll just continue to build onto it and add to it. That's it.
this is great. This will really help us to be organized. Good work. Okay, we've got some good presentations today. Today we will hear about the year-end presentations from Emma and Mark regarding the high-quality school readiness grants and the results-based contracts. Great to have them with us. As you may recall, or those that have been to these meetings, these end-of-year presentations occur each August and are really designed to kind of highlight the grantee activity relative to the prior year. So it's great to get this information for our new board members. So we're going to go ahead and let Emma and Mark give us these presentations.
Okay, well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. And like Jim said, my name is Emma Bont. I've been overseeing the grant for since 2016. And so I've seen it go through some changes. The bill began with HB 96 in 2014. And so today we're going to be going over the bill change. And now, so the bill for this past 4 years was HB 380. And so for this piece, I'm going to be discussing the results, some results that we have from both the High Quality School Readiness Grant and the Results-Based Contract Grant. And so just to kind of give you a preview of the slides before I go through them, I'm going to be, and also to let you know, the scorecard is at the back of this tab. So if you, that's just more of an extended scorecard, but we're just going to be going over some highlights of the scorecard. So the first section is the scorecard highlights for HUSR. And then we also have some post-assessments that I'm going to be going through, and that's going to be compared to the pre-assessment. So every provider has to do a pre-mid and post-assessment. And then we're going to be going over the key entry proficiency levels. And so we have had, instead of the PPVP this full year, we asked providers to do the key entry. And so we'll be going over that a little bit. And then we'll also be going over the results-based contract highlights also. So just to go over the scorecard. Thank you. So this piece of the scorecard, which is in that larger scorecard that you have, and we also have the shorter version, but this shows the grantees that we had in the program this full year for HQSR, and it shows you the number of classrooms, the ECHAS3 scores, the award amounts, and the amount spent. So ultimately we had $19,381.04 that was not used up for this full year, so that money doesn't go out to providers. Providers invoice for those, and so that's just funds that were not spent from the awards provided. And so just to kind of go over the ECHAS3, because I know that some of you, I'm sure you've all read through the bills, but you're kind of new to the ECHAS3 piece. But the expectation for ECHAS3 for LEAs is for them to be able to score a 3. And so what we would do is we would go out and we observe their classroom, and if they're at a 3, then they're deemed to be, you know, high quality, and essentially they may still have other things within their program from those high quality elements that they might still be working on. So just give you a heads up on that. For the private providers, because they tend to be serving students full day, they we have a little bit of a higher expectation for them, so they are expected to have a 3.67 overall score, and then a 4 in language and literacy, and a 4 in student-teacher interactions. And so here I've given you kind of their overall scores, but as you can see, we've got, you know, a wide range between 2, 3, and 5. And so you can see that we've got some, what we do is when we get these scores, we would put an intense report report that is printed out, and we debrief these providers. And so we sit down with them and we explain kind of what we saw. They're able to ask questions, and then we set goals with them to be able to, on top of their gaps within their program, we set goals with them to be able to improve on their FS3s, and then we go back and review those scores. So the next slide is another scorecard highlight. So this goes over the number of students, the percentage of eligible students, and just to give you a background on the percentage of eligible students. A couple of years ago, the board voted that we, you know, that providers have at least 25% of kids be eligible within their program. We were having some providers that were struggling to have that percentage, but also we have providers that are up to, you know, sometimes 90%, 100%, as you can see here. But that was kind of the minimum percentage that we had providers. So this is just so that we can be transparent with you and let you know that this is the percentage of kids that these providers are serving. So, you know, YMCA serves 100%, and then WeFriends is 28%. So there's conversations that we would be having with WeFriends, just because they're kind of on that cusp of how they can start to have more outreach to eligible students within that program. And then, yes, thanks, Jim.
Yeah, I'm just looking at this, and a couple of these really have a lot of chronically absent children. Well, all school districts. Does that really affect their record score? Or is it a result? I'm just wondering.
It might not affect their FS3 score, but it would certainly affect their overall pre-mid and post and PPBT or class, you know, depending on, and so it certainly affects the student outcomes. And this percentage, so, you know, I'll give you a little bit of background on that. So the 10, ultimately, down here, we've defined chronic absenteeism as students missing 10% or more of preschool. And this includes absences, sick days, and even suspension. So anything more than 10%, they are suffering from that. So it is quite a low threshold for absenteeism, and these numbers come from their entire class. So they give us information on how many kids they're serving versus how many eligible students are they serving, and that's what gives us the percentage of eligible kids. And then the chronic absenteeism comes from their overall class. But yes, the 10%, it tends to be low, but there's been, you know, academic articles, and I know Jessica went to a couple of conferences that talk about 10% is really, that's when they start to show that they're kind of not doing as well in their assessments and their...
Do we measure the factors behind the absenteeism?
We don't. We could. I mean, we could ask. I mean, for the LEAs, it might be difficult for them to keep track of that, but potentially I think teachers, you know, if they're having their family engagements, which is the way they should be, they should be keeping track of those things. Yeah.
I think overall it's a 38%. If you take the 344 divided by the 915, 38% of the students are chronically absent, which is very high.
Yeah.
Very high. I mean, it's incredibly high. It's almost 50% in Tooele school district.
Yeah.
Is that typical for this population? I would think.
And that's also a question is how that's distributed between eligible and ineligible children.
Yeah.
So, for instance, is the percentage whole for both groups, or do we see higher absenteeism among eligible children or non-eligible children? I think that would be
right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
To
me, it would be interesting to know the factors.
Yeah.
And chronic absence is cumulative. So, if you're chronically absent in preschool, you're more likely to be chronically absent in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, and then the dropout rate. Correlate. So getting in good habits, I think, early.
And the causes are important too, because let's say an customer related, Salt Lake County has a Green and Healthy Homes project. So we could potentially notify the school district and they could make the connection.
Yeah,
that's great. Thank you for that feedback. I think Samantha, you had a... We had this question last August, and I actually talked to Neighborhood House because they were at PI last year too, and I just asked them what their thoughts on that was, and they said that they actually have a policy. If the children arrive late, they're not allowed to attend that day. So that could very well be affecting their number of chronically absent children. Well, their thoughts were that they were missing instruction time and would be interrupting the classroom to have students arrive like during circle time and during instruction time. And so they made that policy because they were having problems with late arrivals.
Do you know how late? Like 5 minutes?
What I gathered was they were pretty strict about it. It wasn't like, oh, all right.
I actually have the same policy, but once it's in place, then families just fall in line.
Yeah, they said that they had the people that were the students that were chronically late. A lot of them would come on time, but I don't know if the numbers are reflecting that.
Well, if I'm looking at this, I really like to know what the factors are and what the relationship is relative to the outcomes.
Yeah. That's something we can add to the fourth and report this school year, is getting the difference between the eligible and non-eligible, and also for the eligible students, having them give feedback on why there's certain reasons as to why students were...
And then also in the analysis, we've got a correlation between KEEP and PEEP scores. Well, I guess it would be KEEP scores.
Yeah.
See what impact it's having on students.
Right.
And I think that's what Tim was alluding to.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your feedback. So to the next slide, goes over the this next piece, this goes through the elements of high quality in the bill that are stated within the HB 380 bill. So these quality, just know that these have changed for the school year. But we have, providers need to have at least an evidence, and I should say for this particular grant, they have to have some elements of quality. So they don't have to have everything. That's the point of the grant, is to help to get into quality. And so they have to have, a decent amount of these, because it's really difficult when they have nothing to be able to build up and bring up a classroom. So they have to have an evidence-based curriculum, intentional and differentiated instruction, pre-mid and post-assessments. They had to have KEEP assessment this school year, 1-10 ratio, family engagement, teacher education, so a teacher has to have at least a CBA or an associate's or a bachelor's degree in early childhood, and then ongoing professional development and coaching. So just to give you a quick example, ABC Great Beginnings, none of their teachers have teacher education, but you can see that they have all the other elements of quality. So that's one of their gaps within their program. And the requirement is, within the first year, their teachers have to have either a CDA or an associate's or a bachelor's degree. So that's something that we keep track of, and we're continuing on setting those goals with them. You can see that YMCA TO Smith are meeting all of those expectations, and that's a provider that transitioned on to the expansion of seats for this school year. So we gave them an ECA 3, they applied, they're meeting those expectations, so they transitioned on to that next grant. And same with Neighborhood House, they've been with the grant for 3 years, they're meeting those expectations, so they're transitioning on to the expansion of seats grant. Okay, this scorecard highlights really go over the post-assessment benchmarks. So So this these posts are comparing from their pre. So the green indicates growth from pre and mid assessments, from pre-mid to post-assessment. So, for example, when we see the kind of percent right here, the green indicates that they have shown growth. And so 100% of the kids at ABC Grade Beginning are meeting the benchmarks for oral language. And this, just keep in mind that this is their pre-mid and post. So all of these assessments come from their curriculums, and they ultimately, it comes from their nationally accredited curriculum, so ultimately their teachers or their coaches are administering the assessments. Everybody has a different curriculum, everybody has a different assessment, pre-mid and post-assessment, and so they're really difficult to compare, and that's why we have the, you know, the PEEP coming out, the preschool entry and exit profile assessment, is because that is a standardized test that is administered with fidelity, and they we can then begin to start to compare those benchmarks that are happening.
Just a question on the growth. So for clarification, for oral language, is it 100% of the kids are now proficient, or is it 100% of the kids had some growth over the year?
Great question. So 100% of the kids are proficient.
Okay.
And the green just shows that they grew from
not being proficient to proficiency.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Not just that they grew from one level of not being proficient to another level of not being proficient.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, this is interesting to me, and I'm not, maybe there's no correlation, maybe there should be, but I would expect that the higher Eckers scoring, the higher numbers relative to students meeting the benchmarks.
Mm-hmm.
Although, because it's not standardized, you may not have, I mean, you've got just about all of the kids first 100%, you know.
Yeah.
And the Eckers, you know, they're 2.2.
Yeah.
And then you look at West Jordan, and they kind of range between a low of 31% to 87%, and yet they're 5.26 on the Eckers.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you experts have to tell me, explain that phenomenon to me.
Not all assessments are created equal.
and this is very true because, you know, if there isn't a standardized way of assessing students, as much as we monitor and work with the programs and really try to make sure that they're administering these assessments with fidelity, you know, when they don't have an official kind of standardized assessment where they have to keep to the script, you don't know if some of these kids are being prompted, you don't know if they're administering the assessment correctly, and so we're, you know, that's why, I mean, these are, it's essential for them to be administering that pre-mid and post, but I do think that the PEEP and the PPBT provide more accurate.
Could be a false sense of security in some of these
programs.
And I think we're still trying to sort through the more data that we're collecting, sort through the relationship between the classroom observations on those various components of quality and the individual student outcomes. And I think the jury's still out on that. And collecting these pieces all along is going to be really helpful.
Yeah, and ultimately, I think the pre-mid and the one of the I'm sorry, but one of the I think the big points for pre-mid and post is really to inform instruction. And so, as much as we want to compare, that's not I think what the pre-mid and post is for. I think the pre-mid and post is so that the teachers and the coaches and the directors know how to work with these students individually. They know where they're scoring low, and so they can, that informs their lesson planning. That informs the way that they're interacting with those students. That informs, you know, how to work with these specific students during replay and how to be intentional and explicit within their teaching.
So it would be interesting if we had enough data to do a correlative analysis between ACRA scores, and I would say, so I think, as you know, and I'll defer to Mark and Jennifer here, but the literature around the correlation between classroom quality scores and child outcomes is very weak. And we may verify this in our own correlative analysis. But it would be interesting is to take a look at scores on instructional support and intentional support and see if that, because that, at least on class I know, that's one of the only domains that is correlated to student outcomes. And so we might do our own, if we have enough data, I think we are able to do correlative analysis. We might, one, look at overall scores and also just look at in instructional support, intentional instruction, to correlate with not only these results, but I would argue the results on the PEAK.
Yeah.
That'll give us a lot of information as to whether or not we're really getting to quality and what drives student outcomes.
Right. So it'll be interesting what the factors of the certain factors.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Well, it could also help drive how quality grounds are focused, right?
Yeah.
So if we can find correlations in terms of the aspects of ACRS, then when applications come in, we'll have a better idea, okay, do we think this proposed use of money is actually going to get us child outcomes or not. That just gives us a better basis to make resource allocation.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So next up is the key proficiency level, and I'll just kind of, obviously the key assessment is the kindergarten entry and exit profile assessment, and so typically, a preschooler would not be administered this assessment, but we ultimately wanted to be able to have an assessment that's standardized, and also this assessment was also great for providers to get them prepared to be able to attend Jessica Smith's and Jamie Robinson's and Liz Williams. Presentations they had on being able to administer this assessment with fidelity. It was just a nice kind of opening up to this is what we're going to be expecting of you for the PEAK assessments too. So they all went to a training up at the Capitol with Jessica and Jamie and Liz, and they were able to go through some examples of how to administer the assessment with fidelity, how to stick to the script. And they gave them opportunities to be able to practice the assessments with each other so that they could then take this to the classroom and train other people and then and assess the students. So just to, and ultimately this full year, this summer, all the providers have already attended a summer training on the PEAK assessment. So I think they're all ready, they're probably assessing now or finished with assessing. So. So just to give you an update on this, so level one just indicates that, it's red. It indicates that there's significant intervention that needs to happen within literacy. And this ranges from 0 to 25 points. Level two is yellow, and this is 26 to 46 points, and this indicates that they may require in literacy and numeracy some interventions to succeed in kindergarten. And then level three, the green level, this level indicates that students may require minimal intervention in kindergarten for literacy and numeracy. So you can see in numeracy, the numbers are a little bit different. It's 0 to 17. For level 1, 18 to 28 for level 2, and 29 to 36 out in level 3. So I'm going to show you the graphs, but just know that the graphs are color-coded in the same way. So if you see red, just know that that's level 1, yellow is level 2, and green is level 3.
Emma, when was it administered?
So this assessment was administered at the end of this school year, okay. 2019. So I would say April, May 2019. Okay, so we're going to break it up by numeracy and then literacy. So you can see, if you just take a look at this, you can see that 25% of ABC grade beginning kids are at level one, so they're going to need some intense like intervention when they're in when they're moving to kindergarten. They have zero at the level two, and 75% of them are at level three. And this is going to be really, I think, great data to look at when we do have that peak pre and post. And so you can, you know, if you want to take a look at that, you can see that Tooele School District have 2% level one and 8% level three.
It would be interesting to see, compared to free and reduced lunch overall in the state.
Yeah.
How does this compare to low-income kids overall?
Right. Well, and we do have that 2017 data that was released by Utah State Board of Education, but we didn't feel as though we should compare that because we're comparing preschoolers to kindergartners. Mm-hmm. So I think once the PEEP assessment has been released, I think that we can do that comparison. Mm-hmm. And yes, I think that would be very interesting to do that comparison with eligible and English language students also. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, given we get the PEEP in the fall and we get it in the spring, not knowing what summer's like, we just don't have a comparison group right now.
Yeah.
We will have I'm guessing between 5,000 and 10,000 kids for the H2SRE group that's taken in to have another group within, like, the H2SR, which is a much smaller group, but they're all giving the same test. We have a look at the demographic variables on how this is playing out. It's just this time, given the different timing of the test, it did make not the same. Hopefully, it's not that different, but we just felt like we don't want to compare the different time periods.
Sure. Yeah.
We have LEAs that want to get the keys in the spring so they can figure out how to get the coaching in the fall, and we're like, we have to have a very tight testing window to keep it valid. And that was one thing that came up in the
Yeah, and something that Jessica and I talked about in the orientation for both expanded student access grants and also for becoming high quality grants is that we ask providers to be able to administer the PEEP assessment to all of their students, not just eligible. Of course, they would provide us with the, you know, they would take the eligible students from Caitlin Macquarie and
anything
like that. But thanks, Nuna. So we'll have a larger sample size for those providers too, but we'll be able to have that comparison between eligible and eligible students as well. So this is our literacy proficiency of eligible students. We friends data was interesting for this, like they had 0% at level one and then 20 at level two and 20 and 80% at level three. And when they sent in their pre-med and post, they also broke it down by how many times a week their students attend, and it was really great to see their pre-med and post data to see how, you know, the students that spent more time obviously in school scored higher with these skill benchmarks. So that was interesting data to look at too. Does anybody have any questions about the key data that we have for literacy? All right, moving on to results-based contracts. So this really just, I'm just going to provide you a scorecard for this piece. Providers, when they applied for this grant, were already expected to be at quality, so they met those ECHA3 expectations that we set. And you can see the providers here. We have Guadalupe, Little Scholars, Smart Kids, YMCA, and Grant School District. And we required a beginning of year that we had an information report, and then a mid and end of year report. So they were constantly reporting on how many kids they were serving. Also, they invoiced us quite frequently, so we were aware of how many eligible kids and comparable kids. Also, with Mark PPPT pre and post data, we're able to compare those students and what they were reporting. So they had the opportunity to serve 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds half day, and 4-year-olds full day. So that just gives you an overview of how many kids were served. And then you can see their ECDIS-3 scores and their budget. And so $34,721.51 was not spent. And so ultimately, this is like a really brief overview of the results-based contract, but they're already, when they applied, when we looked at their programs, they were already at quality. So it's not always as much reporting when they're, you know, at that quality. And that's the point of the HUSR grant, is to monitor that those elements of quality. So does anybody have any questions about this slide? Any comments? Mark will give you some more information about PPPT, and I think that's going to be a lot more to bring up more interesting conversations. So I'm going to transition the next piece to Mark Innocenti, and he's going to be going over the results-based contract for 2018-19, and going to be discussing the PPPT assessment.
Morning, everybody. I'm Mark Innocenti. I'm at Utah State University. I've actually been involved in some kind of preschool evaluation here in the state of Utah since about 16 years now, actually. Time flies when you're having fun. I'm gonna give you a rundown kind of on some new people in the room, so I'll digress in a couple spots, but kind of the basic approach to the kind of the task that was given to me as the evaluator for this year here really was we wanted to have two groups of children. It was in the House bill that was passed. We had a funded group, folks that didn't receive funding for their preschool placement, and they met a high risk criteria for children, so they were at high risk of later school failure. There's a kind of an adapted, people that are familiar with the ACES tool, Adverse Childhood Experiences, kind of an adapted basis tool that the programs use to identify children at higher risk. So they have to be low income, eligible for free and reduced lunch. They have to have other risk factors. For the most part, the majority of children come from neighborhoods that where they do have issues around school success. And so the comparison group, which in some ways it's a kind of a bad term for them in some ways, but we're comparing them really to children who are in the same program but were better off, were not as at high risk for school failure. And so they are receiving the same program. They may or may not be kind of at the same level of risk. Some of the children clearly were, and some of them, I'll talk a little bit about that. But for the most part, the goal was to get children that were better functioning generally, less risk of school failure. So what you'll see, and although you'll see some differences in the programs themselves, what you see is there's no differences in curriculum or program. So if they are in a given program, if they're in the granted school district, everybody's receiving what the granted school district is. So there's no difference otherwise, other than the fact that they meet a slightly different cutoff whether they're eligible or not. Just so you know, looking back at the groups were different. The funded group had statistically significant lower puberty picture vocabulary test scores and pre-tests. Just to kind of give you a quick overview, the puberty picture vocabulary test, PPVT, is a norm reference measure that looks essentially looks at language development, receptive language development, children are shown a series of pictures. They're asked to identify ones by name. They go through. The PPBT is very strong psychometrically. It's got a huge national normative sample it compares against. It's used in a lot of evaluation studies across the nation, really. It does predict pretty well later school outcomes. So it has some power like that. So we do see the funding group having lower PPBT scores of pretest, which meets kind of what we were going for. They're also ethnically more diverse. And so it's a more European American, Caucasian children in the comparison group, more ethnically diverse kids in the country. That's some of the differences we saw. This is the post-test participation, so you can kind of see where we ended up with. And I think that if you look at the top row, do I have a finger? I do. You look at the top row, I think that gives you an overall kind of funding. So, and again, we were going for about half as many kids in the comparison group as in the funded group, and we were pretty close on that. So we have all the children, so overall we have 1,052 that were in the funded group. The comparison was 402. We have 4-year-olds and 3-year-olds within that with that we looked at. The program's always looked at both. And again, more 4-year-olds and 3-year-olds, we were going for about a third, two-thirds kind of distribution there. And then again, pretty close on that. Thing to take away, I think, here is Granite School District is really the big kid on the block. They have the majority of children in this, and their data heavily influences everybody else's data. It's inevitable because, you know, they have the most kids in here. You know, we have a good grouping from Guadalupe, mostly mixed between 4 and 5s. You know, a little bit from Smart Kids, YMCA, but again, relative to Granite, they are much smaller programs. Kind of the numbers from pre to post. We did have some changing around from pre to post. We had in total, funded children, we had 10,091, 10,000, that would be great, huge. At post, we had 1,052, a difference of 39 kids. The comparison group, we saw more dropouts, 595 at pre, 402 at post, 193 difference. Kind of reflected throughout the data. I didn't put the difference in the 4 and 3-year-olds, which you can kind of see what's going on. So we see more attrition in this group, but I think one thing, so if you look, attrition overall was 3.6% for the funded group, 32.4% for the comparison group. It's a lot of attrition. Kind of consistent with what you were talking about the high absentee rates and things like that.
Can you explain the difference?
No, I can't, actually. I have no idea what there's a difference there.
10x gets weird.
It's
you wouldn't have expected that. You would have expected the higher attrition on the funded group.
Here's what's going on.
Do parents of the funded group have to sign something?
They do.
So they sign
back. And this plays a role, too. If you look here, 109 students, all Granite kids, moved from the comparison group to the funded group during the year.
Oh.
And so that's something that we talked about quite a bit. And then,
so 109 of the 187.
Yes, essentially. Okay. And then the rest are really the kids that are attrited.
So they actually had an attrition in their funded group of 109 students that freed up slots for the comparison kids to move into.
Into, yeah. And they had ensured that...
I apologize, I didn't know anyone was in here.
Yeah,
no problem.
So it
was approved for Granite to make that shift as long as the kids met the high-risk criteria. And so Granite, who has a larger pool of high-risk criteria children, because of where they are, they did make the move, and so... And that would explain some of the percentage difference. I mean, that's a pretty big chunk of kids, really. So that's kind of what went on. And, you know, that's something to kind of be discussing. You know, Granite made a very strong case that they really, you know, they based their preschool program on how many slots that they have funded, and it would impact the program if they did the job. And so.
So where do those 109 students show up on this?
They show up in the funding group on this.
Okay.
So they're, if this thing works for me. So they all show up in this group.
Okay.
That's where they show up. Okay. And so we had pre-test data on them. They moved into that. At some point during the year, they moved. We had the post-test data on them as well. now, so you can pick up there. So, you know, although we do see this big gap, more of it's related to this change, I think, than that. And, you know, when historically we typically see, you know, a fair amount of attrition, but it's usually close to the 10% level, not come. So I think by granted, moving those children kept the attrition for the funded group lower, made it look worse in the comparison. Kind of what was going on there.
But critical for the financial model.
Yeah, and critical for the financial model to keep the funding going for that, given that they're investing quite a bit in this.
But this group wasn't part of the financial. This is results-based contract. This is for results-based contract.
Yeah.
They weren't part of pay for success.
But don't the, well, I may be incorrect, but I thought that the slots were still funded. And that's where
they're not part of the pay for success.
No, they're not part of pay for success.
Yeah.
So results-based contract.
This was the interim bill, 380, last year.
Yeah.
It was the first group that was not part of the pay for success transaction.
Yeah, results-based contracts is what we call pay for success legislation.
Yeah.
That's why I thought it was. Yeah.
Our naming system is off a little bit. These are giving you a picture of vocabulary test scores by assessment and program. So the blue is light blue is pre-test, darker colors post, whether blue or orange, whatever you want to call that. I think the things you pick up, you know, you can look at the all children right off the bat. You know, we do generally see lower, you know, much lower scores for the children that are in the funded group, consistent with what we wanted to have. Higher scores. We do pretty much see positive change. If you look at the overall, we see a little bit more change in the children that are in the funded group, which is kind of what you would expect, and in the comparison group, where they're typically on the PPBT, for those that don't know, if you score, where it's norm reference, basically if you score at 85 or above, you are considered typically developing. So you're in the typically developing range. So the standard deviations of 15, so from basically 7 to 85 is kind of at higher risk, below 70 you're at the most risk. If you're below 70, only 3% of the population scores at 70 or below. So it's a very small number of kids still that score that low.
So just, this has been an ongoing discussion we've had in the school readiness board for years, I think. Most of these kids are already above the standard, the like low rate. So I still think we're either struggling to not get the right kids, or we're making assumptions about these kids that are not bearing themselves out in the data. Meaning the assumption is if they're low income and if they have a lot of risks, they are not at academic benchmarks. And whenever we look at this data for years now, most of them
These are mean scores.
Yeah. And so there, you know, there's a significant number below the 85 mark, and you know, you see in some of the sites, not in Granite, they're at 86. But you know, if you look as a comparison point, if you look at like the studies that have been done with Head Start National, so the National Head Start studies, and kind of what they see and these are pretty large sample studies, is they see kids also the entering children. Kind of in the 80 to 88 range from a PPBT score. So they're still seeing people, so, you know, the range for typically developing goes from the 16th percentile to the 86th percentile, essentially. So even though kids that have a score of 85 are typically developing, there's still some risk for school there. You know, they're still like below the 25th percentile. And so kids from about, this is not going to be exact because I don't have my table with me, but from about 85 to 89, you're still 25th percentile below. So you're still pretty low, really. In terms of, you know, compared to peers who are functioning at the typically about the 50% level.
Okay.
This may or may not, it's not clear in these data as well. And in the paper success data, we pull out anybody who's a special ed child.
Got it.
And so within this evaluation here, we didn't track that during the school year, so there may be some children in there that do end up receiving special education. And so it's not clear.
Okay.
So, yeah.
You know, one thing is the difference between the pre and post funding. Is that tracking previous years and about 3% improvement? You know, it's pretty consistent across the board.
That's a good question. I've got that in the data from that I presented last year to you guys. I'd have to go back. But I think it's relatively good. Let me check for a second. I'll look and see if I can find something. I'll see if I have it on my computer. So that's kind of what you see, and kind of this is really the analysis. And so, kind of looking at, you know, the question is, so the underlying question here is there a difference between pre and post in the different groups? And so, is there a difference between the groups? And so the kind of the way this analysis goes, you take into account where the kids start from. So you enter that into your statistical analysis. So you try and kind of level it out to some extent. You're controlling for where they begin. And then you look at how much progress they made over time. And kind of what we see is that we do see statistically significant differences. So these children, for all children, you know, this group here is clearly doing better. And they did better than this group. And so they did better on the PPVT. We see that for the four-year-olds as well. Same finding is basically replicated. You know, they're statistically significantly different. So, you know, we see the kids who are in the comparison group doing better overall, doing better than the more at-risk kids. We don't see it in the three-year-olds. So although we have a numerical difference here, around 7 points, basically, there is no difference there. There's so much play around the three-year-old kids. These are not different statistically. So whereas three-year-olds, the groups did about the same, and which is kind of consistent with past findings as well. So we don't see a difference, it proves kind of the known in some ways, and that, you know, you expect kids who are closer to typical development to kind of maintain that typical development, and it's harder to move kids from a lower level to a higher level.
In the four-year-olds, were the funded and comparison groups the same in terms of 2 years of preschool?
So this is just 1 year of preschool data.
So the four-year-olds in both groups only had 1 year of preschool?
We don't have that data. Some of them could have.
Had 2 years.
Yeah, some of them could have. But, you know, we're looking over the past 5 years where we looked, that didn't really turn out to be a significant advantage.
Okay. Interesting.
It wasn't consistent. Some years it was statistically significant, some of it was not. And so there's some question. I think one way to look at it is, granted being the big guy on this list, you know, if you look at the difference between their four-year-old and their three-year-old program, the four-year-old programs, again, it's a four-day-a-week program. It's only 2 hours a day, so it's not a lot to begin with like that. But the three-year-old program is only 2 days a week for 2 hours a day. Like, it's significantly less.
Mm-hmm.
Time in class, and so less engaged learning time, less available learning time. So we see some differences there like that. And then, going the wrong way? And I put this one up here because there is kind of called Janice's fault. We want to look at how kids are scoring to begin with from the paper success model. But kind of what this does is it shows you, so the blue is children that were in the typically developing range. So their scores were greater than 85. The orange is kids that are at higher risk. So they're in between the 16th and the 3rd percentile in terms of their scores. That's the orange block. And then the kids at 70, I don't know if the 2 is there, but it's a typo of some kind. But they're less than 70. So less than or equal to 70. So those are the kids at most risk, 3% or below the population. And kind of what you see kind of from the funding group, you know, we see this changing, but it's only by 4 children over time. We see a little more of this group, I think, moving, at least would move into here. So we do see some change in their risk level, but not a lot. You know, here in the comparison, it's a little harder. We start out with most of the majority of children clearly in the least risk category, and they have far fewer kids in the most risk category. So just to kind of give you a feel for where they stand risk-wise like that. And then, just a quick summary for you. So two preschool groups were established, funded in comparison. Funded group as planned were at higher risk for poor school outcomes. If you look individually, kind of what do you expect for where the PPPT score is norm reference, so that if you're right on target, so when you enter preschool and your score is 100, you are on target for your age. So you exit 8 or 9 months later and your score is still on 100, that means that your learning trajectory has been stable. So you are still performing. You were at 100 to begin with, you're at 100 to end with. You've learned new things during the year. That's a good thing. But your score maintains like that. So kind of what we hope to do really with the kids that are more at risk is increase their trajectory so that they would enter, say, with a score of 85 and they would leave with a score of 88 or 89 or something like that. So we're trying to change that. And what we see when we look at just change over time.
And so that means basically that their growth was better than the natural trajectory.
That's what we're shooting for. And so kind of what we see is if you look at individually, the children that were in the program, they made progress during the year for the most part, except three-year-olds. Three-year-olds did not make statistically significant gains with preschoolers. So generally what we see in the preschool is some increase in scores over the years. Kids are in a program, they are from, they meet some risk criteria, they're eligible for free and reduced lunch. You know, we want to see that change. So, you know, we generally see individual change, and that's a good thing, and that's what we want to see. But then we don't see this kind of catch-up with McMyers, and I think it was a big stretch to hope that they would catch up to kids who are functioning more like typically developing children. It's a big push, really. But when we control for initial scores, they remain statistically sound.
So just one last question about the three. Do you have enough data when you take out Granite? Because I think the other programs are full day, or at least they're 5 days a week. So the whole idea of dosage. Do you see something different on three-year-olds when you take out Granite, which is only 2 days a week, half day?
I'm not sure about that. I could do that, and you know, yeah. we're working on planning a meeting for October. I could come back with that. We're going to let you know about that.
Because they're all using pretty much the same curriculum still, right?
Yeah.
They're all scoring comparably on the ECHR. It's actually higher than Granite for a reason. And so you could argue, I mean, there could be a quality difference, but a lot of it is going to be a dosage difference.
Yeah, I think it'd be easy enough to pull and look at. I'll do that. I can pull Granite out and kind of rerun some of these analyses and kind of take a look at them. I think if we combine everybody else, we'd still have enough statistical power to say something. Okay.
Thank you very much.
For this part, my part.
a lot to digest, and I think some pretty good follow-up questions and potential answers. We'd now like to just do an update. In our July meeting, we approved the programs to receive funding for the 2019-2020 school year for becoming quality and student access grants. And Emma's really been busy kind of getting those programs off the ground, and maybe you can give us a little status update.
Okay. Just a quick update of all providers. We sent individual letters to all of the providers on becoming high quality and expanding student access grants. And all of them have, we've had some that have asked questions about the budget changes. We went over those changes last time. But all of them have accepted and sent in their forms for us to continue on with contracts. Logan School District is really the only school district that we're still waiting for some of their forms to come back, because we've had like an ongoing conversation with them.
about their budget. They have some additional budget requests, and so we've had those conversations with them, so they're working on, there's been no change, obviously, but they're just figuring out kind of an adjusted proposal, and we'll send that back to us by the end of this week, so we'll get working on with those. So, to speak to your request last time, Jim, you asked if we could collect some type of a survey or just have a conversation with providers who did experience budget cuts, which was everyone. So Jessica Smith and Jamie Robinson and I will be, we meet every other month, or sorry, twice a month, and we are going to be creating a survey for them to be able to give us some feedback on budgets. So I just wanted to let you know that that's in the workings and that's on our agenda. We've had orientation for both grants, so providers know what to expect, they know how to invoice, they know what the monitoring is going to be, and then the on-site visits, they know they're going to have an FS3. And so the next step that we have is really setting up FS3 visits for the Becoming High Quality grants, and then site visits for the expanded student access, so that we can sit down with them one-on-one and just kind of go over the next school year with them, just to go and do some classroom visits as well. Like I said, we're meeting twice a month with USBE. We've got a big annual calendar with a live Google Drive, on live Google Drive, so we can all add to that. But we have an agenda and a list for every single month until June, so we know kind of what's expected, what's coming up, and so we can all add to that. And so I think that that's going to be really effective. We're going to be going over the monitoring tools, just cleaning those up and getting those out to providers too. And then data, we're just going to be, you had another request last time, Jim, about being more, you know, just being able to collect more data from the external coach to demonstrate how coaching is actually having an effect within the classroom. And so I sat with Samantha and Alda Jones from the Children's Centre to be able to collect really more specific data so that we can present those the next time and demonstrate how coaching is affecting other coaches and teachers and students in the classroom. And ultimately, that's just a brief overview of what we've been doing so far, what we have planned coming up. So I'll just pass the time back over to you, Jim.
Thank you. Thank you for all of you that you're doing. You know, this meeting was originally scheduled with the intention of getting the board's approval for the investor repayments for the Utah's pay-for-success transaction. And we're not able to hold that vote today because of some data sharing agreements that had to be put in place. We got delayed a little bit, and we're going to vote on that in the October 10th one-hour meeting, and that's why that was scheduled for that purpose. But instead today, I think it's a good opportunity to hear more about Pay for Success, really as a funding structure, early childhood Pay for Success initiatives throughout the country, what's going on there, maybe get a little bit of background for those that may not be aware fully of the transaction here in Utah, and a little more about the data and methodology that we're using each year to evaluate the student performance, the outcomes, and to calculate the payments. So we kind of designed this portion of the meeting to provide that information and hopefully give you more context, particularly as new board members, behind Pay for Success, and for everyone to be prepared for the vote that we'll be taking in October. Elizabeth Darby was going to be here, but unfortunately, she's not able to attend this meeting. But we're fortunate to have Janice, who I think was here from the beginning of this, and she can give us an overview of pay for success, our transaction, and maybe a little bit about what's going on around the country. And then Mark will review his data collection process and the methodology behind it for calculating performance outcomes. Janice?
Thank you.
Introduction to pay for success. And I just have to apologize, I'm a little under the weather today. So, if I stagger it all in my speaking, that's for
me. If you fall over, we'll come.
So, pay for success is really an innovative financing model that shifts a focus from outputs to outcomes. And I think you see in a lot of the work that we're doing. Really, the pay for success work helped focus early childhood systems here in Utah on looking at outcomes for kids rather than how many kids, how many seats do you have, how many kids complete the program. So, and this is really important because really what we care about ultimately is outcomes for kids and improving their life trajectory. It also transfers risk of performance from whoever the outcome payer is, which is typically government. To private investors. So typically how government funds programs is they fund activities. And typically they fund activities with requirements around outputs. Often there's no evaluation as to whether or not the program is actually working. So we fund activities, we don't know whether or not it works. And so there's no way to judge how effective the appropriation is. And what pay for success does, because investors only get paid if the outcome metrics are achieved, it really shifts that risk from outcome payers to investors. And so government only pays when it works, which you might argue is efficient from a taxpayer point of view. So how it works is that you have private funders provide the working capital to fund services. And this is important because if funding is going to be on an outcome basis, it's by definition after the program has been implemented. So someone has to put up the money to actually implement the program, and that's the role of the investors. You have measurable outcomes that are success metrics, and the payment amounts that are for a payment amount for the outcome when it's achieved. And this is established upfront in contract. This is a legal document. It's typically a contingent liability or a loan document. It's not a bond. Actually, that's a bit of a misnomer. And so these are determined up front. It's very transparent, and it's set out in a contract. And then if the outcome metrics are achieved, the outcome payer will pay back the upfront funders. That's really, at its very sort of simplest form, what pay for success is. In a number of the projects that I've listed here, you'll see there's some variation on the theme, but this is really at the heart of the financing method. Okay. So today, there have been three pay-for-success projects total, focusing on preschool, was $24 million in investment. Our project, the Utah High Quality Preschool Program, was the first early childhood project in the country and only the second to launch in the country. And I just want to say that as part of the team, we hadn't heard of it. There had only been one project in the UK, Peterborough. We hadn't heard of it. We actually weren't trying to do pay for success. We were trying to get preschool funded, and we were trying to figure out how to pay for it. So we really sort of stumbled into this. There have been four other early childhood pay for success projects, totaling, I believe, that was $28 million, mostly on maternal and child health and child welfare.
That's nationwide.
Nationwide. And this is just some of the, I won't go through all of this, but this is just some of the details around the projects. the Utah High Quality Preschool Program, we had one payable outcome metric, which is reduction in special education utilization in K through 6. We didn't have a kindergarten readiness assessment at the time. Our goal was to get kids into preschool. So by definition, we weren't going to have a comparison group. We actually did talk about doing randomization off the wait list, but the whole idea was to get all the kids in the wait list into the program. It's very hard here to find comparison groups outside of public systems. So, Mark and I tried to do this in another project, and it was almost impossible to get a statistically significant number of children in comparison group who was not attending preschool at all. So, in developing the methodology, we really were figuring out what can we do, what does make sense. And what you see in all the projects that came after this is that there's more than one metric. And that really is the best practice. And had we had the option, I think we would have done that. But because of the ratio of funding for special education to preschool, it was actually financeable with just one outcome metric. That often is not the case, and that was not the case in the Chicago Child Care Center project that launched in 2014. They have kindergarten readiness, special education reduction, and third grade literacy. It's a full day program. It's much more expensive than our preschool programs. So in fact, you really did need more than one outcome measure to make the financing model work. Westminster Public Schools pre-K program. This is in a very high poverty school district in Colorado. A disclaimer, Search and Impact Center was involved in both the feasibility and structuring of this project. So I just want to be transparent about that. And they are looking at scores on the Peabody Picture Book Calculator Test and an early screening inventory, which I think is quite interesting. This is really a quasi-pay-for-success project. Some of the money is outright grant, and some of it is a contingent grant. So it's really a partial pay-for-success project. It's getting very good outcomes. South Carolina Nurse Family Partnership, this is the first maternal and child health. Nurse Family Partnership is an evidence-based home visiting program. Very expensive. This is what's called an evergreen structure. All the funders are philanthropic funders. They're not going to be paid back, but the state of South Carolina is making outcome payments that get put into reserve fund for the sustainability of the project. And that's a very interesting structure to look at to think about sort of projects that are investors partially get paid back and some of the money goes into a prevention fund. The Connecticut Office of Early Childhood Maternal Infant and Early Childhood Visiting Rate Card. This is under their McBee program. McBee allows you to make performance payments within the one-year period of availability. That's in their current funding. In the reauthorization of the McBee program in the Budget Act of 2018, they actually received paper outcomes authority, and they're in the process of writing their guidance around that. They'll have a 10-year period of availability for that project. They don't have any outcomes quite yet. They're still in the early evaluation stage. And then the Cuyahoga County Partnership for Family Success. This is really looking at homeless families and child welfare and looking at the reduction in the length of stay for foster care. And you can see who some of the investors are in the audience. And then also the Connecticut Family Stability Project, which also is looking at adequate placement, reduced referral to DCI, clean toxicology screenings for families. That is the landscape. Overall, there have been 25 projects across all issue areas that have launched to date in the United States. And this is free, the social impact, social impact partnerships do pay for results app, which is providing
the U.S. Treasury put out a NOFA for $100 million in capital payments to pay for success projects across all Asian areas. We should find out in November what's been funded. From what I heard, it's between, Jim was a main proponent of this legislation and couldn't emphasize how important he was to get this passed. So go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I just gave you a little bit of a preview that these are just preliminary, but I think there are 9 submissions, about 66 million potential, and they range from homelessness to birth family, juvenile justice, recidivism, and workforce development. Mm-hmm. So those are the major themes across the country. And there's a requirement that a certain percentage of this money go to children, basically issues around children.
That's right,
50%.
So we expect to see a few more projects launch in the beginning of the year after the grant. So Elizabeth did call me this morning and asked me if I could go through her slides. I'm happy to do that. So the history of the initiative is that it was really a partnership between Granite Voices and the United Way, and also a market center was involved very early on. And really what it was how are we going to get preschool funded? And in the research you see that the difference of special education assignment between low-income kids that have high-quality preschools and those that don't is significant. It's about a 50% reduction nationwide. So that's a cost savings. So our thought was, well, why don't we capture those cost savings and reinvest them back into the preschool program? The more kids you serve, the more kids you serve, it naturally scales up. The disadvantage to that is that you can only fund the number of children based on the prior year savings. And you're only 3 months, you're only 4 months. So we really wanted to maximize the number of kids. So we thought, well, why not capitalize that saving stream by having someone put up the money and then pay them back through that? And the United Way of Salt Lake had a prior philanthropic relationship with Goldman Sachs. Their second largest office is here. And we brought the idea to them. They loved it and started working with us on how to structure this. 6 out of 10 low-income kids in Utah were not kindergarten-ready. And our solution was to provide greater access to high-quality preschool and reduce remediation and other costly categories. A lot of this early consideration was this. We knew we weren't going to get direct appropriation. We knew we weren't going to get outright funding for preschool. The pay-for-success, what we call results-based financing model in terms of a public-private partnership, transfer of risk, was very politically appealing here. And again, I need to give Jim a shout-out because he was extremely instrumental in getting the legislation passed. I would argue we would not have gotten it passed without you. So thank you. And more importantly, all the kids that have had access to preschool.
It was a group effort.
The roles in the pay-for-success transaction were the United Way of Salt Lake, the intermediary, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Pritzker were the investors. The Granite School District was the largest program, had developed the program. Park City, Guadalupe School, and the other providers, the private providers, they have been in a partnership with Granite and using the same model. The idea of the partnership was to get the same outcomes for kids in the private programs that they were getting at Granite, which had very good longitudinal data. Utah State University is the evaluator. And so our first effort at passing legislation failed. United Way of Salt Lake decided, and so we wanted to do a pilot, and we wanted to fund one cohort, and to show that this could work, that this financing mechanism could be implemented, we could track it. And the United Way of Salt Lake basically decided that they were going to put up $1 million to be the outcome payer. It passed their board,
And Ben McAdams, county, who was the county mayor at the time, was on the board, and he said, well, why doesn't the county participate? And they put up $350,000. With that, we were able to launch the project with 1 year pilot. And then based on that pilot, we were successful in getting the legislation passed the following year. It's a bit of a gamble, but it was worth it, and it worked. So the state of Utah, so the United Way and Salt Lake County pay for cohort one, the state of Utah is the payer for cohorts 2 through 5. And as you know, this board is the program on the site for that. So I'm not going to, I won't obviously go through the introduction to the success again, but so the repayment cohort, so I think as Mark has mentioned, you're eligible to be funded if you meet the income and risk factors, but the only kids that the investors are paid back on are the kids that score 70 or below, with 2 standard deviations below the mean or below. And the theory of that is that those kids, without preschool, they would never catch up. They are more highly likely to end up in special education. There's actually a very good research paper that was published in 2015 that shows causal relationship between language assessment at age 3 and special ed places in middle school. So it's not exactly apples to apples, but it provides some substantiating context for the methodology. And so the investors pay for all the kids, but they're only getting paid back on the 20 to 25% that's worth 70 and below. So the state of Utah is getting all the benefit for the other kids who grew up, essentially. So those kids are in the repayment cohort, and it's the performance outcome for that cohort of children who scored 70 or below that is measured in terms of their special ed usage and whether or not they invest with their repayment. With that, I will hand it over to
Thanks, Janice.
Thank you.
So you know quite a bit, so this is just kind of filling that kind of how we went about it. So as Janice mentioned, you know, the goal was not the bonds, but whatever you want to call them, transactions, to identify approximately 25% of the sample that pretests the children scoring at or below 70 on the PPD test. And so that's the 30% problem. Those, as Janet mentioned, those are considered the high-risk group, and that's the group the payment is based on. I talked a little bit about PPPT earlier, so you've got a feel for it, norm reference measure, receptive language skills, good predictive validity. The goal is to fall, and so the way the transactions were structured is we have the preschool data on them, and the entrance, so their score at entrance is the score that was used to identify whether they were in the at-risk group or not. And so how they scored. We did pull out anybody who received special education while they were in preschool was removed from the data set and moved to the transaction. So there's no special ed kids to be. We're still following the children as they progress through school and examine later special education usage. The way the transaction is structured, we are following children through 6th grade. And the reduction in special ed was so we're really looking for, in the data, special education avoidance, essentially. So I make sure these children are not in special ed. So the assumption is, you know, preschool participation for the high-risk group reduce later special ed placement. Investors are paid for special education avoidance only from this high-risk group. And the data we use at this point is data that's collected by the State Board of Education. As part of their, each student has an identification number, state-specific identification number. We're able to follow children over time. And so we look at, we get the data, that's where we're getting the agreement right now, so we can look at the data again. we're looking at whether they are in or whether they were placed in special education during the year, during the past year. And so that's the data that the primary interest. Just to kind of show you the size of the cohort, you know, and although throughout this entire project, you know, we did have 3- and 4-year-old children involved, the focus is really, the follow-up is really focused on the 4-year-old group and what cohort they were in. So they're kind of the primary group. Some were involved at 3 years of age. You know, we see a mix in there. We have some children who got preschool when they were 3 and didn't come back for the next year when they were 4. We see some kids getting both years. We see a lot of kids who just start when they're 4 years of age. So kind of a mix of things in there. But those are the academic years, the cohort numbers. One thing you'll notice, we do have kind of an increasing number in the cohort. It was the way the money came based on the House bill. So we were able to ramp up larger samples over time. So we are, if you think again, like another third of this number is the 3-year-old kids that were being served in the programs as well. So quite a few children received preschool services as a result of this. It's a good thing. Percent in the high-risk category. This is varied a little bit from by year to year. Again, it is based on your PPBD score. Kind of in some preliminary work we had done in the state, we consistently found in the Granite School District 20 to 25% of kids scoring at 70 or below on the PPBD. This is also matched. If you look at the national the Head Start evaluation study and the Head Start FACES studies, which are longitudinal pictures in time of what's going on in Head Start, you see is a similar number of children who score below 70 on the, they also use the puberty picture vocabulary test. So it's consistent with what's out there for at-risk populations. So our percent of kids by year, 28 in the first year, before February 1921. That was our lowest year. And it's always who knows why. So so we've been able to consistently find that we've been able to meet the transaction requirements every year. If you look at the grade children were in this past year, they're cohort 5, just got through kindergarten, 2, 3, 4. So we're following these children over time like that. And then at the October meeting, we'll have information for you about how well they're doing. Just so you can kind of see what it looks like and get a feel for the new folks. This is kind of the progress report from last year when we did this. So it was the last year progress report. But you have the cohort, you know, what their expected grade was in 17-18. We do have that information, but even if they're held back, we still follow them. And then, you know, being held back is less common these days. You don't see how that happens. So the number in the cohort, we do have some attrition from year to year to year. As you can imagine, some kids move out of state. Some kids get lost in the mix. So there is some. So we have some attrition every year that we're unable to find based on the larger data set. So then we come up with the total number of children we actually found for that year. We break it out by the non-risk group and then the at-risk group, which is those children below 70. So you can kind of see both for the non-risk and the at-risk group. If the number in the group, for example, the number of the risks that are in that group that are in special education that year, the payout group, so this is the number of children that the investors get paid back on. They make their money on these kids. And this is just the percent that are in special education. And so, for example, cohort 1, which was in third grade when we presented this, you know, we can 20% of the kids were approximately still in special education. But, you know, the underlying rationale when we designed the transaction was that a higher percentage of these kids would be in special education levels. And so although we are seeing a little bit more as kids get older, as they progress through school, you know, we're still seeing a large number, the majority of kids are not in preschool special education, or in special education. And then, so this is kind of a crosshair, I think. And then this is just to show you how, this is just like for one cohort. This is cohort 1 for whom we have the most data right now, between K1, 2, and 3. And kind of if you look at the numbers, both for the non-risk group and the at-risk group, but you know, we do see increasing special ed usage, which is kind of consistent with what you see in school. Children are more likely to be picked up as the curriculum transitions more to reading, using reading to learn other things. Reading is a tool to learn versus learning how to read. So
how do you, just a question,
yeah.
How do you know if the rate of special ed for these kids, what rate are you comparing them to know that it's lower than where they would have been?
Okay, we don't have strong data on that because we don't have a comparison.
Okay.
It's kind of based on, very much based on the kind of the assumption that these kids were more likely to end up in special education over time. So we don't have a... We didn't have the funding to do a comparison to look at kids who, who had been in the program before this, for example, and kind of what happened to them over time. We weren't able to kind of put together a comparison group of other children that we could look at over time that didn't have a preschool.
So we're only paying out on the kids who didn't, we're not looking at the rate at all to measure performance.
Right.
We're just paying out on each individual child who did not go
into
special ed. Even though the rate itself might be even higher than the average rate for, and I don't know what it is,
yeah.
I haven't looked at the USBE data in over a year, but
general population would be interesting in those
states.
But if you look at low income,
13,
if you look at low income kids, it's more like 17-18%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So here, don't forget, the correct way to look at it would look at the overall for both the risk and the non-risk group, because here, that's only 19% of the high-risk group, right?
Right.
But at the blended rate, it's going to be lower than that. We can actually calculate that.
I was just curious if they're still entering special ed at a higher rate than their low-income peers.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you have to look at low-income peers who scored 70 and below.
That's
way different, right? So. Although what you could do is you could take a look at preschool generally and look at that rate of assignment versus low-income kids in the state. But it's not a perfect comparison because those numbers will have preschool and no preschool.
But that makes sense. Even though we've been doing this for several years, I just clarity on the fact that we only pay out on the kids who don't enter special ed. That's how the payment is calculated.
From the
high risk group.
I think Jennifer's kind of got an advantage now with where we're using statewide assessments. She will be able to look in the future to kind of get a good feel for it because we'll be able to track children over time. So the data collectors and in her office are going to have tons of data to play around with.
Get ready,
John.
Thanks.
And that's,
sorry.
But that was just a kind of a question, just more of the same.
Great. Was this helpful to new members?
Yes.
Good. All right. I think we have, Nuna has some kind of a few items to share and would like to get our input on the research subcommittee. And then we'll open for public comments.
I'll stand since everybody comes to standing. So I first wanted to take a moment to welcome John Collins. John, raise your hand. John is new at the Utah State Board of Education, and he's been hired on in part to help us with the research. And so I just wanted to kind of remind everyone of some of the work that we had a work group do and one of their recommendations. I know a lot of you were at that meeting in April where we talked about this, and I sort of briefed all of the new board members but wanted to just take a moment to refresh everybody's memory. So we had a work group form to assess which quality tool we should be using in the program, and they made some recommendations, and we went ahead for this year to maintain consistency in using the Eckers. That work group also said that they wanted to have a bit more time to do a little bit more research, not only on the quality tool, but also to sort of think more broadly about a research agenda for this group. And so one of the recommendations that this board approved and we wanted to revisit today was to formulate a research subcommittee that would be an ongoing body stemming from this body to help inform your work moving forward. And so some of the things that John would staff and lead that work group to kind of help inform your work. So one of the key priorities would be to establish that research agenda, which is of course an ongoing sort of living, breathing agenda, and then to establish a quality tool. So is the class or the Eckers or some combination of those tools appropriate for use in these programs when we're looking at high quality? And also to then establish the student performance benchmarks that we're using for programs in next year, because we've all been hearing about the PEEP, which you will all hear more about at an upcoming meeting, but to really say, okay, if we're letting programs come on who are high quality and their students are performing well, what do we mean by students are performing well? So those are sort of the things that would be on the forefront of the research subcommittee's agenda, but of course that work will you know, evolve, and so there will be additional things. So with that, I just wanted to say we don't need a formal vote because you've all already voted. The board, when it was still five members, voted to go ahead with that research subcommittee. But I just wanted to let everybody know that John will lead that, and they're going to start their work really soon. And so I wanted to see if anybody had thoughts or if we wanted to have a moment for discussion about like who should be on that subcommittee. So in my conversation with Mr. Johnson a few weeks ago, we really wanted to emphasize the need to kind of keep it at a manageable level, too many cooks syndrome we want to avoid. So I think we're looking at maybe six people, a sort of ongoing membership, and then bringing in experts ad hoc depending on the subject as needed. And so I know that child care and youth trustee board of education would have membership on that. I assume that probably Janice would be interested. Yeah, she was in the work group. Mark, I know, contributed to that work, and so bringing him on. So any other thoughts, considerations that John and I can kind of take back before that group meets, or does everybody feel kind of comfortable with the plan?
Any other data wonks in this group here that would like to...
We don't have to be committee members, right?
I mean, that's right.
You have a couple, yes?
Yeah, I'm also with you.
You would like to be, okay. And can you just introduce yourself?
So I'm Jimmy Hernandez. I just finished up at BYU, working at GSP and PCP. My background is mostly Jonathan.
Great.
He's
serving a lot in the upstart capacity, so looking at the influence as we're bringing on Upstart as being a partner in the program, that would be an interesting way of saying that.
So that gives us how many?
I think we want to kind of revisit and make sure that, like, you feel comfortable with everybody who needs to be on that, Office of Child Care as well.
So you've got the names?
We've got names, and so we can kind of put that together. But the plan would be that they would start meeting with some in some sort of regular manner, and then they would come back to this board at meetings to report on kind of where they are, get your pulse on the direction that they're headed, and then we can kind of work through goals where you all need to have some initial input on tools that we're using, student benchmarks, and that kind of thing. The other quick update I wanted to share is that we are developing a governance policy. So in your binders, you'll see that there is a state handbook for boards and commissions, which is really long and really technical. And so we wanted to create something that's a little bit shorter, that kind of just gives an overview of the chairman's responsibilities, what the voting procedures are, what the procedure is about having proxy votes and that kind of thing, just so everybody feels comfortable about regular order of business. But before we do that, because that'll take some work and we want your input and want to circulate some drafts that everybody feels comfortable with, I know that there have been some conversations with new board members coming on around potential conflicts of interest. And so now that we're at our second meeting with new board members and that you all have a better flavor for all the work that this board oversees, we wanted to give you an opportunity to declare your conflict of interest. So in your binders, there is a conflict of interest form that you should review. You're welcome to hand me a copy today that we can just scan and have on file, or I can just go ahead and email everybody an electronic copy of the form for you to sign and return. So bearing in mind everything that this board oversees, just kind of think about what you might want to declare. And what we'll have in the governance policy is a procedure for what happens if there is a vote before this body that you have a conflict in. And so that's not to say that you can't serve on the board, but it would be whether you recuse yourself or whether you're part of discussion but recuse yourself from the vote. That's all procedural, and there's not a official guidance from the state, so we have some flexibility in what you all want to do procedurally, but this gives you an opportunity to at least make those declarations now. So.
Is there a time when you want to have these back?
Maybe in the next couple of weeks, and I can nag you over email to get them. Feel free to leave a copy with me if you want to sign them now, but I'll follow up tomorrow probably and just send everyone an electronic copy and ask for them within the next couple of weeks. Is that okay?
Any of you that serve in any kind of government capacity knows that this is basically the
standard. And if you have specific questions, feel free to email me and I can follow up and I can get input from our legal department if you're not sure of something. So they helped to develop this form. And the last update, you should all have on your calendars two meetings. We'll have a final meeting for 2019 in October, and as was mentioned by Mr. Swartzen, Mark, and others, the purpose of that meeting primarily is to have you hear Mark's data presentation, similar to the slides you just saw, but on this last school year for paper success, and we'll kind of walk you through what the investor repayments will look like, and so you'll officially give us the thumbs up to move ahead with that. We may also have an opportunity, depending on time, because that's only a one-hour meeting, to hear more about the PEEP and the development of that, and kind of give you a sense of what's being assessed since we're using that tool. And then perhaps if the research subcommittee already has some stuff on paper to share with you, we can do that, but that's a lot to cram in 1 hour. So make sure you've got the October 10th meeting on your calendars, and then our first meeting in 2020 will be Monday, March. Which will be a 2 hour.
Those are in-person meetings here.
Those are in-person meetings, and we, of course, have that electronic meeting resolution to accommodate if folks are out of town or if there's an emergency that arises, but I know the preference is to have everybody in person. It's just a little bit easier to do questions and answers and ensure that we have everybody in the room for votes. And as always, email me if you have questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. We want to open it now to any public comments. Do we have any questions?
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning. They're like technical questions, so excuse me if I get a little too technical. So on this last paper success analysis rule, where you're looking to see if what contribution to school reduces eligibility and special education, what variables are you counting for when you run an
analysis? Based on the nature of the transaction, is it just a very simple analysis? It's based on, and the cutoff point is based on their score on the PPBT when they entered the preschool program. So whether they were 3 or 4, that doesn't matter. So whatever their pre-test PPBT score was, that's what puts them in, and it's based on the way the transaction. So if they enter preschool, they're assessed with a PPBT. That defines whether they're in the most at-risk category. And then after that, it's really just looking to see, I collect data on all the kids. One of the concerns was, that we didn't want to potentially look anywhere unaware of what these children may be. So at this point, data are de-identified, and I just have kind of their SSID and what group they were in to begin with, and we just look and see whether they are in special ed, not in special ed. That's very straightforward.
Now that PEEP is available to the general public, will we collect that type of information from everyone, or only those who are participating in the grant? Or
that's a question. Jennifer, I don't know if you can speak to that outside of these grants, but you all kind of.
Yeah, so there are a lot of us who are motivated to want to.
Yeah, this year we are only doing the ones that are in the grant just from a technical getting the system up and running. We anticipate future year, maybe even the spring one, to be able to allow others who want to move it. It was just getting our tech people to get all the LEAs and private providers that we don't generally put into our system and into the system. So it's taken a little bit. We turned this around very quickly for USB to actually have a test and have a system that you can enter the data digitally into. So this initial initial kind of fall implementation for entering is kind of reserved for people in the grants, but moving forward, our goal is to let anybody who wants to put the data in. It gives us a more robust data picture, but also gives reports and things that people using the test don't have otherwise.
So for those of us who would want to do that now, just do the test and just keep them
for now, and then eventually once the system opens up, there'll be that opportunity.
And we'll find out whether we were doing them with the family.
It'll be, I mean, the biggest thing, you'll get your overall, like,
summary.
Fabulous, thank you. There you go.
I'll take that back to the community. We'll spread that word.
Yeah, please do. It's a lot of moving parts when we ever create an assessment. We at least learn from Keith so we can do it better with Keith.
Yeah, we just got all of our
good. Well, thank goodness these acronyms are.
We tried.
Maybe that's a little controversial.
Maybe that
makes things you can put in the binders. Acronyms.
Right. Yeah. Any other comments? Very good. I think this was really an informative meeting, but even though we couldn't take a vote on the contracts. I entertain a motion to adjourn.
Awesome.
You can make it first.
Make it.
Jamie, make the motion.
I make a motion that we can adjourn then.
I'll second.
Thanks again, everybody. This organization. Thank you.
Thank you.
Montana, do you want, would it be best for us to...